www.parstoday.com/en.
The morning ceremonies marking the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson Imam Hussein begins in Karbala on Ashura, the 10th day of the lunar month of Muharram. President Joe Biden defends the way he withdrew U.S. troops from Afghanistan, saying chaos was unavoidable. Also, Washington says it will limit some Chinese passenger air carriers to 40% capacity after Beijing imposed similar limits on four United Airlines flights. Thank you for joining us. Muslim worshippers have initiated the morning ceremonies marking the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, on Ashura in Iraq's holy city of Karbala. Ashura is the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar. It is the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in 60 AD. They were killed by the tyrant of their time, Yazid, during the Battle of Karbala. The annual ceremonies attract millions of mourners from various countries, but this year, like the previous one, many large gatherings have been canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Iranians have attended mourning ceremonies under strict health protocols to mark Tasu'a, ahead of the day in history that witnessed the martyrdom of Shia Islam's third imam. Salman Kujuri reports.
Millions of Iranians have taken part in nationwide processions on Tasu'a, the ninth day of the Muslim month of Muharram, a day before the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia imam. This year, Shia Muslims in Iran have held mourning ceremonies during the first 10 days of Muharram under strict health protocols to remember Imam Hussein and his 72 companions, who were all martyred after fighting thousands of soldiers of the ruling tyrant of the time, Caliph Yazid, in Iraq's plain of Karbala in 680 AD. Tasu'a is also known as the Day of Loyalty and Resistance, which was devoted to Abbas ibn Ali, Imam Hussein's half-brother, in deference to his sacrifices in the Battle of Karbala.
The best lesson which we get from the tragedy of Karbala is that Hussein and his companions were rigid believers in God. They illustrated that the numerical superiority does not count when it comes to the truth and the falsehood. We will not allow the legacy of Imam Hussein to slip into oblivion. We owe our identity as Muslims to his sacrifices, but it doesn't mean that we ignore our health. We hold the mourning rituals while sticking to extreme health protocols.
During the ceremonies, eulogists recite the events of the Battle of Karbala, and Islamic scholars elaborate on the underlying messages of Imam Hussein's stance against tyranny.
This year, in order to combat the coronavirus, we have strictly observed the health protocols. Come rain or shine, Muslims don't miss out on Tasu'a and Ashura ceremonies. Not only as an occasion for mourning, but a means to preserve the legacy of Imam Hussein and pass it on to the next generation.
Muharram ceremonies symbolize the eternal and unwavering stance of truth against falsehood and humanity's struggle against tyranny, the cause for which Imam Hussein was martyred.
Tasu'a is a symbol of truth, bravery, loyalty, and human dignity. Is not limited only to Muslims. Rather, it is respected and commemorated by followers of different religions and faiths, inside and outside Iran. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Islamic scholar Sayyid Husseini says Imam Hussein's message has motivated and empowered all resistance forces and groups that are fighting tyranny in several parts of the world. Let's take a listen.
The message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a universal message, and it is not limited to a particular time and a particular place. And it's not only for the people of that age where Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life, he is facing to the whole humanity and he's talking to the whole world. So our brothers in Lebanon, if they were victorious against the tyranny of Israeli regime, was based on Imam Hussein alayhi salam's message. And after that, our brothers in Syria, if they were victorious against the ISIS, also it was inspired by Imam Hussein alayhi salam's message. Today, if our Yemeni brothers are resisting against all mights of the world, against all of the coalitions which was created by MBS, is also because of the message of Imam Hussein. And if in future Iran and all resistance access will gain victory against the Yazidis of our time, also it's going to be inspired by Imam Hussein. It is continuation of the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and inshallah by inspiration of the blood of Imam Hussein, the final victory against all odds of the world, against the tyrants of the world, is going to come.
The U.S. president defends the manner in which the American troops withdrew from Afghanistan, saying chaos was inevitable.
No, I don't think it could have been handled in a way that we're going to go back in hindsight and look, but the idea that somehow there's a way to have gotten out without chaos ensuing, I don't know how that happens.
Joe Biden added that the U.S. had a limited time frame to work within, as the August 31st deadline for the troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan was drawing near. He noted that he had to comply with the agreement his predecessor, Donald Trump, had negotiated with the Taliban in 2020, where the U.S. would have to deploy even more troops to the Central Asian nation. Biden blamed the fall of Kabul on Afghan officials fleeing the country and the U.S.-trained Afghan military surrendering to the Taliban. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials said they had seen no clear indication that the Afghan capital would fall to the Taliban in a matter of days.
So Afghan security forces, did you feel that they were ever up to this fight, or did you not see this coming, that they were not up to the fight?
Well, I stood behind this podium and said that the Afghan security forces had the capacity, and by that I mean they had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
General Mark Milley said U.S. intelligence had indicated that multiple scenarios were possible, including the collapse of the army in weeks, months, or years. He added that the priority now lies in evacuating American forces and citizens. Speaking at the same presser, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said there are about 4,500 American forces in the Afghan capital Kabul to help with the evacuation. He, however, noted that the U.S. is nowhere close to where it wants to be in the evacuation operation from the Kabul airport. The airport has been the scene of chaos as hundreds of Afghans have been trying to flee the country in the past several days. Political commentator Danny Shaw says U.S. imperialism in Afghanistan has failed and their forces have been kicked out by an indigenous resistance. Here's more.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2-3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb, despite all of this, the most sophisticated army in the history of humanity could not even make a dent in the social fabric of Afghanistan, the different nations within Afghanistan, the different linguistic groups. They have their own history. And regardless of what we say about the Afghani resistance, it's been an anti-occupation resistance, and they marched into Kabul without really any U.S. Resistance. How many years and decades of bombing causing just to Iran, over the Iranian border, 2 million Afghanis have fled, never mind the other millions and millions who fled abroad. This is a big country, an important piece of the global chessboard, which U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
The U.K. government has admitted that they will not recognize the new Taliban government in Kabul following the shock takeover by the group this week. The British Prime Minister made the announcement during a debate on the UK's response to the latest developments in Afghanistan. The government also received heavy criticism over its chaotic withdrawal, failed promises, and efforts to reject many refugees. Robert Carter reports.
The UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
The World Food Programme and United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees warn of a humanitarian crisis of incredible proportions in Afghanistan.
In the past weeks, tens of thousands have fled their homes. Currently, the overwhelming majority of displacement is taking place within Afghanistan itself. That's where humanitarian efforts also need to be focused. Over 500,000 people have been displaced within the country since the beginning of the year. Acute humanitarian needs are now spiraling. 80% of those forced to flee within the country are women and children.
The UNHCR representative called on Afghanistan's neighboring countries to keep their borders open, while the WFP said 14 million people are facing severe hunger in Afghanistan. The Food Assistance branch of the United Nations added that the conflict in the country, as well as a drought and COVID-19 outbreak, have pushed the dire situation into a catastrophe. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says he has left Afghanistan in order to prevent bloodshed in the country.
I am in the United Arab Emirates for now to prevent bloodshed. I'm considering returning to Afghanistan to continue my efforts to bring about justice and build a government run by Afghan people, and also maintain the Islamic and national values and accomplishments of Afghans.
Ghani made the remarks in a video message sent from exile in the United Arab Emirates. The former Afghan president also denied the accusations that he took large sums of money with him as he departed the presidential palace. He added that he left on the advice of security government officials. The UAE foreign ministry said it welcomed Ghani and his family into the country on humanitarian grounds. Ghani left Afghanistan as the Taliban entered Kabul and took control of the presidential palace. His decision has come under heavy criticism from Afghan people and politicians. August 19 marks the 68th anniversary of a coup in Iran that toppled the then-democratically elected government led by Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. The coup was staged by the U.S. and U.K. in response to Mossadegh's efforts to end their dominance on Iran's oil industry. The following report gives you more details.
On August 19, 1953, the U.S. with the help of Britain staged a coup against the democratically elected government of then-Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. They did so as Mossadegh sought to limit the control of Britain's Anglo-Iranian oil company, the AIOC, over Iranian petroleum reserves. Mossadegh had introduced a bill to nationalize Iran's oil industry. It was passed by the Iranian parliament on March 20, 1951. Mossadegh's decision was also backed by religious figures led by prominent cleric Ayatollah Abulqasem Kashani. As a result of the efforts, Britain's four-decade rule over Iran's oil industry came to an end. The AIOC had enjoyed monopolistic control over the nation's oil industry and used to pay only a small share of their revenues to the Iranian government. In retaliation to Mossadegh's move, Britain and the United States imposed sanctions against Iran's oil industry. They also staged their coup to topple Mossadegh and replaced him with a Western-backed monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. After several decades, the U.S. admitted its role in the coup. That was confirmed in documents the CIA published in 2013. According to those documents, the CIA begins drafting a plan to bring to power through covert action a government in Iran that would be preferred by the United States. May 13. The CIA and British intelligence officers meet in Nicosia, Cyprus, to draft plans for the coup. The CIA's Tehran station is also granted approval to launch a great propaganda campaign to discredit Mossadegh's government. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill gives final approval to the operational plan for the coup. U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower gives the same approval, too. Mossadegh, suspecting the British and American governments were plotting against him, holds a referendum calling for the Iranian parliament to be dissolved. Mohammad Reza Shah signs a royal decree dismissing Mossadegh. Word of the Shah's support for the coup spreads quickly across Iran. The coup begins, but falters and then fails because Mossadegh received advance warning of the plans. The Shah flees to Iraqi capital Baghdad. Several Tehran newspapers publish Mohammad Reza Shah's decree. Thugs and ruffians paid to demonstrate take to the streets, and another coup begins. General Fazlullah Zahiri comes out of hiding to lead the movement. By the end of the day, Iran falls into Zahiri's hands and members of the Mossadegh government either go to hiding or are imprisoned. The U.S. benefited from ousting Mossadegh and usurped a significant share of Iran's oil wealth following the notorious coup. The Shah's pro-Western dictatorship continued for 27 years. It ended with a 1979 Islamic revolution that paved the way for today's Iran.
The U.S. Transportation Department says it will limit some Chinese air carrier flights in retaliation to similar limits imposed by China on four United Airlines flights. The order said the department will limit over a four-week period each of four Chinese carrier flights to 40% passenger capacity. Beijing said on August the 6th that it was imposing sanctions after it alleged five passengers who traveled from San Francisco to Shanghai tested positive for COVID-19 on July the 21st. Washington is at loggerheads with Beijing over several issues, including trade, technology, and regional security.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. السلام عليك يا سار الله
As arrows reach the sky, creation is in shock as you prepare to die. Everything you gave without complaint. You died a tragic death, but you did not die in vain. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein.
In the limelight.
Recent papers produced by the UK government's scientific advisory group for emergencies, SAGE, have suggested that the arrival of a coronavirus variant that evades vaccines is a realistic possibility. We'll prepare for you an article written by Michael Savage. The piece has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. It's titled, Experts warn UK government new COVID variants would set us back a year. Ministers are being pressed to reveal what contingency plans are in place to deal with a future COVID variant that evades current vaccines, amid warnings from scientific advisers that such an outcome could set the battle against the pandemic back a year or even more. Recent papers produced by the UK government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, have suggested that the arrival of a variant that evades vaccines is a realistic possibility. SAGE backed continued work on new vaccines that reduce infection and transmission more than current jabs, the creation of more vaccine production facilities in the United Kingdom, and laboratory-based studies to predict evolution of variants. With the arrival of a new variant seen as one of the main dangers that could intensify the crisis once again, prominent scientific figures stressed the risks. Professor Graham Medley, a member of SAGE and a leader of the government's COVID modeling group, said it was clearly something that the planners and scientists should take very seriously, as it would put us back a long way. He said, it is not that different to the planning that needs to be done between pandemics. A new variant that was able to overcome immunity significantly would be essentially a new virus. He added, the advantage would be that we know we can generate vaccines against this virus, and relatively quickly. The disadvantage is that we would be back to the same situation we were about a year ago, depending on how much impact current immunity had against the new variant. Hopefully, evolution is slow, so that new variants arise that are only marginally evasive rather than one big jump. Mark Bagenlin from Imperial College University of London's COVID-19 response team and a member of the government's SPIM modelling group said preventing the importation of variants of concern with moderate to high immune escape properties would be critical, as these could lead to future wave orders of magnitude larger than the ones experienced so far. He said, it is unlikely that such a new virus evades entirely all immunity from past infection or vaccines, adding, some immunity should remain at least for the most severe outcomes such as death or hospitalization. We would most likely be able to update the current vaccines to include the emerging strain, he noted, but doing so would take months and means that we might need to reimpose restrictions if there were a significant public health risk. The amount of restrictions would be a political decision and would need to be proportionate with how much this virus would evade current vaccines. It comes with a further loosening of restrictions in England in coming days, when fully vaccinated people and under 18s will no longer be legally required to self-isolate if they come into close contact with someone with COVID. They will be advised but not obliged to take a PCR test instead. Daily COVID cases have been hovering around the 30,000 mark. The latest figures from 13th of August showed that a further 32,700 had tested positive, and another 100 deaths were reported. Meanwhile, all 16 and 17-year-olds in England will be offered a first dose of vaccine over the next week to give them some protection before returning to school in September. Britain's Health Secretary Sajid Javid urged older teenagers not to delay. He said, "Get your jabs as soon as you can so we can continue to safely live with this virus and enjoy our freedoms by giving yourself, your family and your community the protection they need." Boris Johnson's former senior advisor Dominic Cummings has already called on the government to publish a variant escape vaccine contingency plan and suggested MPs should explore ways of forcing ministers to do so. One scientist speaking on condition of anonymity said they would like to see the publication of the National Risk Assessment relating to COVID-19 contingency plans. Liberal Democrat health spokesperson Manina Wilson is backing the move. She said, "It is critical that people have confidence in Boris Johnson's COVID strategy and trust him not to repeat the same mistakes of the last 18 months. She added, "Through refusing to self-isolate, breaking their own rules and making mistakes that have cost lives, the government has lost public trust. Transparency is the only way to begin winning that trust back." Stephen Reicher, professor of psychology at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, said, "It very much makes sense to be prepared. Scotland is setting up its standing committee on pandemics. It will be interesting to see what emerges on a UK level." Stephen Reicher said, "In the longer term, we need a systematic inquiry into what went wrong and right so we are prepared and also so that we can institute systemic changes to protect us. The pandemic has been like a barium meal, which has exposed so many deficiencies in our society. We can no longer pretend we're not aware of them. This has been a deafening wake-up call. Let's make sure we don't press the snooze button." Government sources said Public Health England and others were monitoring the situation through rapid surveillance and genomic sequencing of the virus. The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, "The vaccination program had built a wall of defense." They said, "We are committed to protecting the progress of the vaccine rollout, and our world-leading genomics capability are at the forefront of global efforts to stay ahead of variants, with over 500,000 samples of genome sequenced so far." Official figures show the United Kingdom recorded 93 new COVID-related deaths and 29,520 new cases on Saturday, 14th of August. Data from Public Health England shows two doses of COVID-19 vaccines are more than 90% effective against hospitalization from the Delta variant of the coronavirus, the dominant strain in the United Kingdom.
Food for thought. Salam and condolences on the poignant day of Tasua, the day Imam Hussein, peace upon him, gave respite to not just the Umayyad forces that had surrounded him, but to all humanity. And for all time to come, to distinguish truth from falsehood, good from evil, virtue from vice. Here is a thought-provoking phrase
from the immortal martyr of Karbala. Do you think you can frighten me with death? Could a worse disaster befall you than killing me?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام لا تجعلوا علمكم جهلا ويقينكم شكا إذا علمتم فاعملوا وإذا تيقنتم فأقدموا.
Imam Ali stated, "Do not turn your knowledge into ignorance or your conviction into doubt. When you gain knowledge, act upon it, and when you acquire conviction, proceed on its basis." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the beautiful lessons which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this idea of helping one another. In this day and age and in this world where we live, we find that this idea of helping one another, this idea of self-sacrifice and altruism is no longer very prevalent among the people. As time has went on, people have become more selfish, more individualistic. It's all about me, mine, and myself. But we find that in the historical texts as well as the books of traditions, we find that one of the things which is very well known and famous about Imam Ali alayhi salam is the fact that if anyone asked him for help, Imam Ali would immediately help that person. This, dear friends, is a very important lesson for us all. We must try our very best to help each other as much as we can. We should help our families, we should help our friends, we should help our relatives, we should help our neighbors, we should help our community members, we should help our society, and we should help them even if they are non-Muslims. For this is what Islam teaches us. We must help these people, we must help each other, and really it is via and through the means of helping one another that we will be able to create a safe and just and peaceful society. Now, at the same time, we must create awareness that there are people who don't want us to help each other. Matter of fact, they want us to fight each other. They want the Muslims and the non-Muslims to fight each other, to quarrel with each other, to have fights with each other, to have wars with one another. This is not what Islam teaches us. This is not what Christianity teaches us. This is not what Judaism teaches us. Human beings, we will go further and say, human beings innately, they don't have this urge and this desire for war and domination. The pure essence of a human being wants it to help one another, to support one another, to make sure that if anybody calls out for help, we go and we help them. And this, dear friends, is what we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Anybody who went to ask Imam Ali for help, he would surely help him. And is this not how it should be when our God, when the God, when Allah the Mighty, the Exalted has said, "Call upon me and I will answer." Beautiful and profound teachings given to us by the universal persona, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." Protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. Ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Muslim and Shia, or Mu'min and Ja'fari. We have to realize, and I think that is the message we have to understand from this, is that these names are very important names. They are our mark of identity. But these names come with certain demands upon us. And that is what, you know, we have to understand here, that when we look at the statements that we have from our imams, yes, the Quran, the hadith of the Prophet, the sayings of our a'imma, sometimes they point out our weaknesses, not because they are condemning us, rather they want us to reach to higher levels of Islam, Iman, and Tashayyu. We believe that these, you know, concepts, Islam, Iman, and Tashayyu, they are levels. And a true follower of Ahlul Bayt will not stop at one level. He will constantly try to improve and advance himself or herself
to higher levels. The purpose of Azaf, Sayyid al-Shuhada, is nothing but this. We talk about the hadith that the Imam said that there are 10 darajat of Iman. Salman was on the 10th level, Abu Zar on the 9th, Miqdad on 8th. Where are we? Is it minus zero? Or is it first? If it is first, we had to move to the second one. If it is second, we had to move to the third one. This hadith is not only to praise Salman and Abu Zar and Miqdad. Remember, they were not masoom, they were like us. We are not talking about the darajat of Iman of Ali and Ali Ali. You know, they are not the issue of darajat there. Rather, loving them, believing in them, and following them takes us to level at different levels in darajat. And so this darajat are not for the Aimma. This darajat are for us. And this is where we have to realize that when we look at the name, you know, look at the reality and the demand of the name Muslim, the name Mu'min, the name Shia, and the name Ja'fari.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludwig Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except there are scant references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza Pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats
which were essentially virtual vessels to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite the tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high